Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Keith Krueger, and today we're very fortunate to be joined by Michael Walzer, Professor Emeritus at the Institute of Advanced Study and Emeritus Editor of Dissent Magazine. Author, editor, and political theorist, Michael describes himself as someone who has made a living writing political theory. Michael still writes for Dissent Magazine. His latest book, A Foreign Policy for the Left, Yale University Press, 2018. Professor Walzer, Michael, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Michael, you mentioned in your preface to A Foreign Policy for the Left that many people, including your parents, help you think about politics and defend political positions. You would have been an early teen about the time of the Hiss Chambers testimonies before Congress. Were these events something you recall being discussed at home?
I don't remember. I mean, I can tell you what my parents would have said, but I don't remember them saying it. They would have wanted to believe Alger Hiss and worried that some of what he said wasn't believable. And they would have wanted not to believe Chambers and sure. would have worried that some of what he said sounded plausible. But when I remember my parents' instruction about politics, what I remember most clearly is when I was 7 or 8 years old and they told me never to cross a picket line. So that's the beginning of a leftist's education.
Sure. Thanks for that. As your family experienced that period, hey, to what extent would you agree with the assertion that this was the first real confrontation in the culture wars of the past half century?
I don't know. The culture wars may have begun with the Popular Front. The effort of the Communist Party to create a culture that a popular culture that supported left politics, and the resistance of some anti-communist intellectuals who thought it was propaganda and kitsch. My mentors, my political mentors, who were formed in the 30s, would have said that the culture wars began then.
In the 1930s.
Yeah.
There you're referring to Irving Howe and...
Yes, and Luther and the people who are my political teachers.
Let's fast forward a little here to 1968. King and Kennedy both assassinated. What stands out in your memory of that year? And I'm sure it's many things, but when you think back about your writing and your solidarity with your colleagues at Dissent and beyond, how do you make sense of the past, your personal past, as situated within that of our larger shared national history? And I'm thinking of this in light of your final chapter of the book, Thick and Thin, Moral Argument at Home and Abroad. You have a chapter 5 there called The Divided Self. And among other things, your defense of difference, but also your description of the self as divided three ways: interests, identities, and ideals. I'm not sure though, Michael, that reference there to the divided self makes the question any easier for you to answer.
Yeah, well, 1968 was a time of fierce divisions on the left and around and across the country. And I'm not sure I was internally divided. At that time, I felt pretty passionately on certain sides, although I would say I think that the sides I chose were more willing to recognize and deal with difference than some of the people we opposed. What I remember most clearly from that year was the division among my friends and co-workers between those who wanted to oppose the war by draft resistance or by bringing the war home, which meant some version of native terrorism, and those of us who wanted to join the Gene McCarthy campaign and wanted to, we thought, stop the war by winning an election. And I was one of, I actually traveled with McCarthy, and I was in, I was on the West Coast with him when Kennedy was assassinated. So those were trying times. If you want to get a sense of my position then, in 1968, a group of radical students occupied University Hall at Harvard University, the administrative center of the university. And this was to protest the war and the university's involvement in the war through programs like the ROTC, the Reserve Officers Training Corps. So I was against occupying the building, but I was supportive of the students who did it, and I tried very hard to help them escape expulsion and suspension. I tutored them on how they should speak to the administrative board that was going to consider their expulsion. So I was against the radical action because I thought there were more effective ways of politics, and I didn't think the war should be fought out in American universities, inside American universities. But I liked the kids work. Willing to act, and I tried to help them stay at the university.
Yeah, that's an insight there. Well, before we get back to a foreign policy for the left, Michael, hey, let's give listeners who may be less familiar with your work a lay of the land, so to speak. In the preface to your first edition of your widely read and influential book, Just and Unjust Wars, your opening sentences point out, and I quote, "I did not begin by thinking about war in general, but about particular wars, above all about the American intervention in Vietnam. Nor did I begin as a philosopher, but as a political activist and a partisan." This distinction you make right there between a person of thought and a person of action is also reflected, I think, in the cases you choose to write about in the book. That is, you discuss real historical examples in contrast to hypotheticals. Can you tell us a bit about the significance of that approach? And likewise, how beginning as a man of action, an activist, a partisan, made a difference in your writing and political theorizing?
Yes, well, it's central to my own sense of my political writing. I have always been an engaged citizen. I began very early, not only writing for Dissent, but also at the request of the editors, going south in 1960 to meet the students sitting in at lunch counters in North Carolina and to write about what they were doing and to encourage them, to support them. I don't think political theory should be a merely academic enterprise. And I don't think it originally was. Writers like Hobbes and Locke were engaged in the politics of their time. Hobbes defending the king and defending an authoritarian state, and Locke defending religious toleration and limited government. They wrote their theories in support of their activities and their commitments. And that it has always seemed to me that that's what political theory should be like. It isn't. I understand the value of climbing a mountaintop and looking at a great distance at humanity and trying to write about human beings as abstract individuals and addressing what they should do or not do in eternity, for rather than here and now. But I've never wanted to write that kind of philosophy or theory. And so I did go to school with some very, very talented abstract analytic philosophers who used weird hypotheticals. But it always seemed to me that an argument, if it was to be persuasive to my contemporaries, had to address the situation of my contemporary. And so I needed examples that they would recognize as examples from their contemporary politics or from a history that they at least were familiar with.
Did you then, in terms of writing style, is there any one in particular you tend to imitate or?
Well, it was Irving Howe, I suppose, or George Orwell. George Orwell has this marvelous essay on politics in the English language, which we used to send to dissent contributors. This is the way you should write.
There you go. Nice.
Irving believed that we should write for the general reader, who may be an imaginary figure, but he wasn't a professor. And that was very important.
Sure. Yeah. And yes, and that's a interesting thinking of your audience. And there's a flip side to that. You note in the preface to A Foreign Policy for the Left that Irving Howe once wrote that left politics is, and I quote, steady work. You use this as lead-in to point out you have a family of steady workers in all the causes of the left, which have made all your books possible. Can you share a bit about that kind of solidarity with your family and what has made it special to you over the years?
Well, I think everybody wants children and grandchildren whose lives and work that they can recognize and value. I have a daughter who is the CEO of an organization that does early literacy training for families at risk, for the families of immigrants and poor people. I have another daughter who is the co-principal of a high school in Manhattan, which is really the work of the Lord. A school that is roughly one-third white, one-third black, one-third Hispanic, not by design, but because that's the way the student body has shaped up, and it makes for an extraordinary educational experience. And I have my oldest grandson works in an organization that tries to keep people out of prison, to make the courts work in a way that doesn't end in massive incarceration. And those are the kinds of work that I can just sit back and admire my children, my grandchildren. I have a granddaughter who's just begun teaching in Boston's last vocational high school. Wow. And she's teaching English. She's teaching Shakespeare to people who will be car mechanics and beauticians. And she loves it, and she loves them.
So all in the family. Nice. Well, and moving on from there, hey, you've been writing for Dissent magazine since the end of your undergraduate days at Brandeis University. Can you describe how you decide what issues you'll write about? What's your process of prioritizing? Has it changed over the years?
Well, in the beginning, I was a kid who took on assignments. I wrote about what Irving Howe wanted me to write about, or Lou Kutzer, or any of the editors of Dissent. And at a certain point, I began giving assignments to other young people. I think what things I have written about are the things that my fellow citizens are at that moment most concerned with. I wrote about issues like conscription and civil disobedience in the 60s when those were central issues. I wrote about what the kids in the South were doing when we thought everybody ought to notice what they were doing. I was running around the country giving talks against the Vietnam War in 67. When the Israeli preemptive attack against Egypt took place, and suddenly I was defending the preemptive attack and attacking the American war, and there were some people who thought that wasn't a consistent position. If you were against war, you should be against war. And so I had to figure out had to argue that there were good wars and bad wars, just wars and unjust wars. And my book came out of that experience, the experience of arguing in front of sometimes critical audiences.
Dissent was a pivotal point from which you were bouncing ideas off of them. They were challenging you. And then essays you wrote there, or the articles you wrote, then become book-length pieces.
Right.
Nice. Solidarity and a kind of philosophy of loyalty is one thing. But as Stuart Hampshire titled one of his short tracks, Justice is Conflict. And though you may have grown tired of telling the story, for those of this that cut our teeth in elective courses like comparative political systems, it has a special resonance. And I'm speaking about Harvard University in 1970. You taught a course with Professor Robert Nozick called Capitalism and Socialism. This was before you both became well-known authors, Nozick with The Libertarian, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, and yourself with Just and Unjust Wars. Can you tell us what that might have been like from a student's perspective? What were your required readings, and how did you approach the classroom? Were you and Nozick similar in style, or quite different?
Quite different, I think. It was we were friends. And one of the ways we dealt with the arguments we were having in class was to play handball, to go to the gym afterwards and have a game of handball. The nature of the course was literally an argument. He would give two lectures laying out an argument, and I would respond with one lecture, and he would respond to my response with another lecture. Then I would give two lectures, and he would respond, and I would respond, and that's the way we went. And I was defending a version of democratic socialism, a liberal version, market socialism. I wasn't a radical egalitarian. I didn't wear a Mao jacket to the class. And he was defending a libertarian, quite radical libertarian position, which was summed up in one of his lectures when he said that he believed that capitalism was a just economic system, and that a revolution to establish capitalism in the United States would be justified.
It sounds like Ayn Rand.
Yes. I don't really remember the syllabus. It's about half a century ago. I'm sure that he assigned Hayek and that I assigned the English socialist R.H. Tawney, who was one of my favorite writers. I think Bob Nozick was very, very smart and very, very quick. I think I had to work much harder in that course than he did. But it was 1970, so although he probably made the better arguments, I think most of the students were on my side.
No doubt. Well, let's stay anchored here for a moment, because it was within a year that Harvard professor John Rawls published his already much discussed A Theory of Justice. And by 1974, Professor Nozick, your co-teacher there, had published Anarchy, State, and Utopia. You had already published Obligations, Essays on Disobedience, War, and Citizenship in 1970. So two questions for you. First, what was the genesis of that collection, and what was your vision for that project at the time? And secondly, would it be a fair characterization to say that the subject matter differences between you and your two Harvard colleagues at the time reflected a clear distinction between you as partisan political activists and the professors as pursuing, say, grand theories? Or do you think that oversimplifies it too much? In a way, I guess, is it fair to say that you represented more of a kind of applied political philosophy relative to their political theorizing, at least in terms of Rawls?
That's probably right. I mean, Rawls was, in fact, a very good social democrat, but he wasn't engaged politically. Bob Nozick did once attend a Libertarian Party convention, but also he was not a political person. So yes, I was that was a difference between us. Yeah, now Rawls had some students, some followers who tried to apply his theories to make a politics out of the difference theory or the original position. But he was reluctant to make those kind of moves.
Well, that's kind of another issue, I suppose. Let's move on from Rawls and not get kind of sidetracked with him. The Vietnam War was front and center still in 1970. Obviously, May Lai Massacre, U.S. Army sentencing happened that year. The shootings at Kent State University. And New York City's riot in Manhattan's financial district, where construction workers attacked Vietnam War protesters. A new book, The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the Working Class Revolution by David Paul Kuhn, focuses on that event. And he was just on the New Books Network speaking with Susan Lee Bell at St. Joseph's University. And he argued that Hard Hat Riot, as he calls it, foreshadowed America's current polarization and highlights the fracturing of the traditional FDR coalition. I may be reaching here a bit, but in your thick and thin moral argument at home and abroad, you have a chapter there entitled Justice and Tribalism, Minimal Morality in International Politics. And I realize this is as a domestic event, but the political tribalism aspect of it and the idea that this is representative in a way that still resonates today, that is blue-collar workers and tradesmen pushing back hard against mostly college-educated protesters that are exempt from the draft, it seems like it has its current counterparts. Do you interpret its significance in that way, a kind of historical artifact of, say, class polarization?
Well, it certainly was an expression of that, but I can tell you about an earlier expression, which I've written about often in dissent. In 1967, we organized in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the Cambridge Neighborhood Committee on Vietnam, which was doing community organizing against the war. We sent people to knock on doors to try to find a family that would offer their living room so that we could have a block meeting where we could talk against the war. We organized a referendum in the city of Cambridge against the war. And in that referendum, 40% of the residents voted against the war. We lost every working class district in the city of Cambridge. We carried Harvard Square and its surroundings, and it was easy to explain what happened. First of all, we had a sociology graduate student who studied the results, and it turned out the higher the value of your home, the higher the rent you paid, the more likely you were to vote against the war. Hmm. It was the workers of Cambridge who voted for the war. And it was, the reason was obvious. We were sending Harvard kids exempt from the draft to knock on the doors of families whose kids were in Vietnam. That's a losing strategy, but it revealed already in 67, it revealed the coming breaks between the more educated, more highly educated, and lefter parts of the population and a patriotic working class. Now, there were a lot of other reasons the break when it came, and I think it's very important to try to assess the responsibility of people like us for the break. The neoliberal policies of Clinton and even Obama represented a kind of abandonment of the work of the American working class, the people who had been the base of, as you said, of the New Deal coalition. So yes, that the politics began with the war. They were the patriots, and we were the radical people who didn't love America, who carried Viet Cong flags in our demonstration. I was always against that, but that was so common. So it began then, but it has a combination of political and economic reasons. And the break is now very, very serious. In the 2016 election, the town where I grew up, which was Johnstown, Pennsylvania, a steel town, Bethlehem Steel. The steel industry was when the union came in 1941 and when the steel industry was flourishing, it was a Democratic Party stronghold. In the steel industry disappeared. There were no steel workers in Johnstown anymore. And in 2016, Johnstown voted 2-1 for Trump. And Princeton, New Jersey, one of the richest towns in America, voted 8-1 for Hillary Clinton. And there you have the story of American politics, a very important part of the story.
Yeah, that's a good snapshot. Well, thinking about now, say, the scope of politics and justice and the need for reconciling opposing political groups seems a given. But trusting other people, especially those who don't share your own politics, seems like risky business, even when we all share a flag, a culture, and a language. Fear and loathing are factors, but I want to ask you about resentment. In your book, Spheres of Justice, you introduce the idea of complex equality and tyranny. Resentment against the prevailing ideology is, as you said, and I quote, almost as pervasive as belief, unquote. Social conflict indicates there's a push and pull here of forces. You share passages from Pascal and Marx that lay out complex equality. Can you share some of how you explain their arguments? Also, can spheres of justice be considered a byproduct of your seminar with Nozick, and or is it a response to Rawls's theory of justice more directly?
No, it is definitely comes out of the course with Nozick. The lectures that I wrote in that course helped me to formulate the book. It is also a response less to Rawls than to the Rawlsians, because those were the ones I was most engaged with. The central argument of complex equality, it's an argument against the radical egalitarianism of some of the 60s leftists. It's an argument that we can tolerate inequality in, say, the market sphere, so long as money buys only a fancier vacation for you than for me. It makes it possible for you to be a collector of old books or paintings. That kind of inequality we shouldn't worry about. If money buys political power, if money buys better health care than is available to your fellow citizens, if money gets your kids into colleges that other Americans can't get into, that's when we should worry. We should worry about when the possession of one good distorts the possession of other goods. You could say that in the United States, it's the power of wealth that distorts other distributions. In the Soviet Union, in the old Soviet Union, it was state power that distorted all distributions. If you remember the Communist Party and an official of the Soviet state, you got a beautiful summer home, you got vacations in the Crimea, you got health care that no one else got, and so on. And so the idea of is that if the spheres are autonomous, if you get a professional appointment because of your competence and not because of your family connections, You get a political office because you are persuasive to voters and not because of the money you spend on advertising, and so on. If all the social goods are distributed for the right reasons, then we will have a much more, we won't have a society where everyone is the same or everyone is equal. We won't have uniform outcomes in any of the spheres, but we will have a much more egalitarian society across all the spheres, because some people will prosper in one and other people in another. I was never sympathetic to, or it's a Rawlsian idea, actually. It may be the biggest difference between us, that the talents we have are a matter of luck, and they should not affect distributive justice. And I believe that we have to deal with, it's the people with their talents who are the agents and the subjects of justice. And they are the ones we have to deal with. And I want to say that John Rawls deserves the fame he won, even if his intelligence or his wisdom was a luck of the genetic draw. Even if that's true, it doesn't matter. He deserves the fame he got. And if someone has a green thumb and can make money in the economy, and if he's a successful entrepreneur, I'm quite willing to have him earn more money than I do, so long as he can't use it to buy political power or things that don't belong to the realm of money.
So that's a key thing, that you don't, those things aren't convertible to something else from one sphere to the other.
The central argument of the book.
Nice. Well, kind of moving on from spheres of justice, I guess it kind of in the background here, there's another election upon us, as you know, and due to the pandemic, voting's already begun in earnest. If people who actually vote are taking advantage of online and mail-in voting, you would think this could make for a record turnout given these options. And yet, with the freedom to vote comes, of course, the freedom not to vote. This right to vote resonates especially for those who live in countries lacking that democratic duty. One refrain you hear from American people sometimes who don't vote is the notion that their vote does not matter. This is concerning, of course, and especially when that kind of thinking comes from younger generations. I bring this up because in 1970, your book, Obligations, Essays on Disobedience, War, and Citizenship, was published. What was your message about citizenship back then, and has it changed at all since?
It probably hasn't changed. It had some qualities of the divided mind that you talked about before. I do believe in an active citizenship. I want something like a participatory democracy. I want citizens to be engaged. At the same time, I once wrote an essay for Dissent, well, it's in that book, called Two Cheers for Participatory Democracy. I think it is important that citizens have a right, as you said, to withdraw from political life, to spend more time with their kids, or to go off somewhere and write poetry and ignore the political realm. I worry that if you insist too much upon activism and participation, which are very good things, then you may get the rule of the activists, the people who will have the most time, the deepest commitments, who are willing to sit longer at a meeting than anyone else. It happened in all the left organizations that I know about. We believed in participatory democracy, but it was a handful of people who were so committed and who didn't have families or work with fixed hours, who ruled. Mm. And so you want a political system that rewards participation, but that guarantees to non-participants a say in the government, which means you want representative democracy rather than direct democracy. You want room for, I say this in the article, you want room for people who participate and also for people who kibitz. You have to beware of the tyranny of the militants.
That's a good way to put it. the tyranny of the militants. One of your Harvard colleagues, maybe not now, but same school of government, Alexander Kasar, just wrote a book called "Hey, Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College?" And he spoke with Lily Gorin here on New Books Network, and he mentioned that, you know, there's many reasons it still exists, but we almost changed the Electoral College most recently in 1970 when the House of Representatives approved a constitutional amendment for a national popular vote that was later defeated in the Senate. I wanted to ask you, I realized you may not have looked at this all that much, but do you think the popular vote would help end this type of fatalism with regard to personal voting?
Well, it would help, given what seems to be the fact that the votes of people in states with small populations counts much, much more heavily than the vote of people in New York or California or Texas. Yes, in a democracy, we want one person, one vote, and we want the votes to have the same weight. And the Electoral College obviously is designed to make that impossible. I don't see how a constitutional amendment could ever be passed. It could get through the House. But it will be opposed in the states that have such a greater weight because of their small populations, and they are not going to ratify an amendment of that sort. So I'm afraid we're stuck with the Electoral College for a long time to come.
Yeah, that may be the case. And speaking of voting duties, President Trump, and talking about this election just months away, the anthropologist Wade Davis at the University of British Columbia just wrote an article in August for Rolling Stone entitled "The Unraveling of America," among other things, especially regarding the country's COVID-19 response. He wrote this, and I just wanted to get your reaction to it. He says, and I quote, "Evidence of such terminal decadence is the choice that so many Americans made in 2016 to prioritize their personal indignations, placing their own resentments above any concerns for the fate of the country and the world, as they rushed to elect a man whose only credential for the job was his willingness to give voice to their hatreds, validate their anger, and target their enemies, real or imagined. One shudders to think of what it will mean to the world if Americans in November, knowing all that they do, elect to keep such a man in political power. But even should Trump be resoundingly defeated, it's not at all clear that such a profoundly polarized nation will be able to find a way forward. For better or for worse, America has had its time." I wanted to ask you, reading the Rolling Stone article, I realize this is as much, if you read the whole thing, it's as much lament as critical observation. And his point, it goes on, hey, that we've lost the very idea of society, in quotes, and with our cult of the individual. From your vantage point, Michael, to what extent do you agree with Davis's stark thesis?
Well, it is rhetorically a success. It's a very powerful piece. I think it is greatly, I hope it is, but I also think it is greatly exaggerated. And I also think it is the contempt that he expresses for the people, the men and women, his fellow citizens who voted for Donald Trump in 2016, is a very dangerous politics. People voted for Trump for many reasons, some of them for the reasons he gave, some of them because they believed in a Supreme Court that would overthrow Roe v. Wade, some of them because they were politically and economically vulnerable in new ways. And they were trying, and they found that vulnerability not being expressed and talked about by the Democrats, as did should have been. There are many people who voted for Trump who voted for Obama 4 years earlier. So I would not be quick to give up on those people. I also think his view of American decadence is in part expressed vis-a-vis China. And a lot of people are thinking that way. The fall of America means the rise of China. And in fact, that is a possible, the world may turn that way over the next 50, 75 years. But it doesn't have to. America has resilience, I think. And America together with the European Union makes up, is still capable of hegemonic rule. And more, we don't have to think about hegemonic rule if we are able to imagine a world of in which there is a division of labor among the most powerful states, among the US, the EU, China, Russia, India, Brazil. Not quite a concert of nations, because in fact, there isn't equality among the nations, but a concert of powers. There are different ways with imagination we can think about and work toward a world order that isn't simply American hegemony versus Chinese.
Yeah. You make a good point about the peace fomenting that same polarization that we're just talking about with the hard hat riots. It's almost contempt in a way, and certainly an oversimplification of people's motives, which again kind of comes back to thinking about your divided self. There's a lot more to people and how they think and their motivations than sometimes these pieces. And like you, and as you said, it's rhetorically quite powerful. Davis is actually quite the writer, a cultural anthropologist. He started as an ethnobotanist. What I wanted to kind of move on to, though, was I wanted to ask you a little bit about this idea about anthropology. He's a cultural anthropologist, and anthropology, this study of human societies and cultures, although you're formally a political theorist, you knew a seminal figure in that field, Clifford Geertz. You were both at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And listeners may be familiar with his influential The Interpretation of Cultures. Can you share a bit about Clifford Geertz and how your relationship with him influenced your own thinking and scholarship?
He was a good friend and a teacher in many ways. And I think that I am, we talked about my commitment to the use of historical examples. I also use anthropological examples, and that's largely because of Cliff. I think that the philosophers like Rawls, when they weren't reading philosophy, they read economics and psychology. And when I'm not reading political theory, I read anthropology and history. And sure, it was Cliff directed my reading. He was very committed to the study of culture and to the diversity of cultures. He didn't like the next generation. This is very interesting. The next generation of anthropologists, produced in part by people who'd grown up in the 60s and then went into the field in the 70s or 80s, and who went into the field and wrote about themselves. And Cliff thought it was very important to go into the field and write about the natives. And he was important. He was a cultural anthropologist who wasn't a relativist. He really believed that it was possible to get things right, that the goal of the anthropologist in the field was to get the culture right. So I do think of Spheres of Justice as the closest any of the writers about justice have come to anthropology.
Interesting, yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. And maybe we'll leave aside the anthropologists and maybe dispense with the Rolling Stone article. That was actually a piece, I'm sure, that was written for his latest book. So there really was a polemical, rhetorical flourish to that, I suppose. But hey, we've talked about it a bit already, but let's try to give listeners a better sense of your latest book, A Foreign Policy for the Left. I'm thinking it originated as a dissent article of the same title in August of 2014, but I'm not sure. You correct me on that. In your dissent article, you write about the default position, which becomes the title of the introduction of the book. And I quote, "This is what I will call the default position of the left. The best foreign policy is a good domestic policy. How many times have we argued against foreign adventures and unnecessary wars by insisting that our fellow citizens would do better to focus energy and resources on injustice at home?" End of quote. In your introduction, the default position, you write, I quote, "Political wisdom isn't necessarily militarist or pacifist or anything in between. It requires a steady commitment to conciliation and compromise so long as these are possible, and a readiness to fight when necessary. The two are equally required. That combination has always been a problem for the left." Can you put these together for listeners? Can you add anything more to the default position as you've articulated it? And I'm thinking here in the background about your mention of Charles Beard, the economic historian, and this thing he called continental Americanism, and the New Republic, the Charles Lindbergh and the American First Movement. Is there a link there with that stuff?
Well, let me first respond to the idea that a left politics requires conciliation and compromise when that's possible, a readiness to fight when that's necessary, and that combination has been very hard for the left. The use of force is very hard for the left, and the classic example is the policy of the British Labour Party and the French Socialists in the 1930s, when they watched Hitler and watched the rearmament of and under a Nazi ideology, and voted consistently against rearming themselves. And why? Because they thought that the basic left position was anti-militarist, and that is a left position. But like every other political position, it's right most of the time, but not all the time. Okay, so the default position is very, very old, and I identified it first in the Bible. The message of the biblical prophets, the message of prophets like Isaiah, was to the Israelite people. The message was, if you do justice, if you don't grind the faces of the poor, if you protect the widow and the orphan, then you will endure forever in the land that God has given you, whatever. So that's the argument. If you want to be a light unto the nations, as Isaiah said the Israelites should be, all you have to do is sit still and shine. And that's been left politics for a very, very long time. We're very good. I think in the history of the left, you have to say, we've been right most of the time on domestic, on social and economic issues. And we've very, very often been wrong on how to deal with tyrants or conquerors abroad. One of the essays in the Foreign Policy for the Left is about humanitarian intervention, which I think if a massacre is going on in Rwanda or Cambodia, somebody should stop it. And the use of force to stop it is justified. In fact, may be morally obligatory. And that is a position that many, many leftists have simply denied, refused. So I am a, it comes out of just and unjust wars. And it may come out simply of growing up in New York during World War II. That may be the key to everything. If you grow up during World War II, you know that some wars have to be fought.
Thanks for shining a light on that. Can you explain a bit about leftism abroad? That is, the view that everything that's wrong with the world is America's fault. What's the primary source of this? Kind of along the lines we're just talking about, I realize it's not just one thing. I have to ask, does the 1958 book, The Ugly American, play into this at all?
Well, it may be an expression of it. Yes, I think the left has, many leftists, not all of us, have adopted a position that starts as anti-imperialist and then turns into anti-American. Because of America's hegemonic role around the world. And I have always thought that a left foreign policy has to work case by case. You can't say that, you can't assume as a starting point of arguments that whatever the United States does in the world is done for imperialist reasons. The United States is, along with the Soviet Union, primarily responsible for the defeat of Nazism. And we are also primarily responsible for the defeat of communist tyranny. So that's, you have to recognize that. The world would be much, very much worse off without American power in the 1940s and again in the 50s and 60s. On the other hand, I think the war in Vietnam was an unjust war. I think that many of our interventions in Central America have been, in fact, imperialist interventions. I thought that the first war in the Gulf, the first anti-Iraq war, was justified after the invasion of Kuwait. The invasion of Kuwait was an act of aggression which the world had to respond to and which we led a response to that was just. I thought the second Iraq war was immoral, unjust, also crazy. So you judgment, political judgments have to be case by case. You have to look at what is actually happening in the world. There are many parts of the world where America is helpful to the people on the ground, and there are other parts of the world where what we're doing is helpful only to the oligarchs or the tyrants. Sure. And we have to distinguish, and we have to say yes sometimes, and we have to say no sometimes.
That's what you're referring to, I take it, in global and domestic justice, the chapter, I think it's like chapter 5, where you make the point that ideas regarding justice, hey, justice is contextual or needs to be.
Yes.
And in your postscript, the title is Can There Be a Decent Left? We really come back to the notion of resentment from a left angle when you ask this question, is there any way of escaping the politics of guilt and resentment on the home ground of a superpower? Can you share your reasons why moving beyond, you mentioned Philip Roth's articulation of it as embitterment and not thinking, as a way, you give some reasons why as an attempt to begin a debate.
Yeah, I wrote that piece right after 9/11. Right after the attack on Manhattan and the Pentagon. And I was furious at the response of many, many leftists who said we had it coming. That was their essential response to an attack that killed 3,000 innocent people who were not armed and were not fighters in a battle. And that the piece comes out of that response, and I was and one of the explanations that I gave for that response was the sense of people living in a hegemonic power, which America clearly is, may feel guilt and resentment about the role of their own country. It was easy in America during the Vietnam War to feel things were being done in our name, which we felt guilty about. We felt we should be doing something to stop the war, and we weren't doing enough, and so on. So that produces feelings of guilt. But that's not the right way to respond to an attack on your fellow citizens. The response of so many leftists reflected a lack of sympathy with, of loyalty to fellow Americans who were attacked, killed in an act which was a terrorist act. It wasn't an attack on a military base. It wasn't a response to a military engagement. It was simply a terrorist act, and I do not believe that people on the left should ever accept the killing of innocent people as a political political tactic.
Well, and even I think the position Saddam Hussein himself was gloating. So you weren't on the right side if you were gloating with Saddam on that one. As you sympathized with the victims of 9/11. And that whole, it was like, it was one of those moments, like knowing where you were when John F. Kennedy or Robert F. Kennedy or Martin Luther King were shot. One of those moments, it was like the 9/11 moment. Did that then later make going to war in Iraq, it made it so much easier. We wanted to believe something that may or may not have actually had all the facts behind it.
Right. Well, the first response was in Afghanistan, and I thought, since al-Qaeda was not merely being given a haven by the Taliban government in Afghanistan, but was actually being supported and helped in an effort to defeat the Taliban and expel al-Qaeda, was justified. I thought that the way we went about doing it, trying to do it first on the cheap through alliances with warlords in Afghanistan, and then never investing enough money in the rebuilding of the country afterwards, because we were going to go on to Iraq and we needed resources for that campaign. That was wrong. We were right to go in, I thought, and wrong in the way we went in and in the way we stayed in without investing the necessary resources. And then the going to Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. There was no reason for that war.
And that's probably well trodden territory. A kind of a side question then, as far as Bin Laden goes, and do you feel that he should have gone to trial? That the argument that, hey, we've got an international court of justice, it would have been, in order to make a point about the rule of law, the international rule of law, that we needed to do that and not just...
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. We don't really have a fully stable world government with a judicial wing that also has executive power. I think there were reasons to think that bringing Bin Laden to trial would have also provided an occasion for widespread terrorist attacks.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I am. If you think about, suppose we had done it with a drone, without putting our soldiers at risk. We've killed a lot of people with drones, and a lot of them have been the wrong people, but sometimes they are the right people. If you think about targeted assassination, the real question is, what is the target? And can we hit the target without killing many, many people around the target, as we have so often done?
Yeah, and I don't mean to try to pin you down on that point. I just, as you were talking about how we mishandled how we treat people. You know, we go in and we do something, but then we leave people behind. And I think you were, I think it was maybe in this piece where you had talked about how well the British had given us a lesson about that.
Yes, yes. We did a book, Descent did a book called Getting Out, about how to get out of Iraq. And we asked scholars to write chapters on getting out, how the British got out of the American colonies, how the French got out of Algeria, how the British got out of India. We had a whole series of articles, and actually the most honorable exit was the Brits from the American colonies, because they recognized a commitment to the people who were going to be vulnerable in the Republic, in the independent American Republic. They to the Tories, as they were called, the American Tories. And they gathered them in New York, 50 or 60,000 of them, and they took them, some of them to Canada and some to Britain, the richer ones to Britain, but okay, in these boats that a couple of hundred people at a time. So it was a big project to take out 50,000. Sure. And they did it. And then you think about the French in Algeria who left behind so many people who were just going to be murdered by the FLN, and the Americans in Vietnam, that hasty exit from Saigon with people left behind who were simply killed or sent to re-education camps. Yeah. So yes, yeah. Even after an imperial conquest or a period of colonial rule like the French in Algeria, getting out still entails responsibilities. You have to do it in a certain way that rescues, that saves the people that you have compromised.
Yeah, no, that was an interesting piece. Well, hey, we haven't even come close, of course, to scratching the surface of your latest book, Foreign Policy for the Left, and again, Yale University Press, 2018. But you've got many books. This is just one of them. I did notice in Thick and Thin, Moral Argument at Home and Abroad, you've got a new preface for that, and that's dated 2019, I think.
Yes.
I guess what I hope what we've done is at least highlight your larger project for those listeners interested in politics and political theorizing from whatever perspective they're at, hard hat or hippie side, whatever that may be, left side, I should say. Hey, you recently wrote an article for Dissent magazine, and you've been writing for many years. How long have you been writing and editing for Dissent magazine?
I wrote my first article for Dissent in 1956.
Hey, well, what are you contemplating these days in terms of ideas? Do you have any current projects you're working on?
Yes. First of all, I have another a book coming out next month, I think. Which is a conversation with a book-length conversation with a French political theorist, which has already been published in France and will be published here in the next month or two, called Justice is Steady Work. Back to that phrase.
Back to the Irving Howe, yeah.
And I'm working on a book, or I may be working on a book. Sometimes I think I'm working on a book about the adjective liberal. Mm. And it derives from I'm inspired by two books. There is a book by the Italian anti-fascist intellectual who was murdered by Mussolini's thugs in exile in Paris, who wrote a book called Liberal Socialism. And then I have an Israeli friend, Yael Tamir, who did her doctoral dissertation at Oxford with Isaiah Berlin, and that produced a book called Liberal Nationalism. So I was thinking about liberal socialism, liberal nationalism, what is the adjective doing in those cases? And so this is a book about how I think of myself as a liberal Democrat, a liberal socialist, a liberal nationalist, a liberal Jew, and what is the adjective doing? What does it mean? It'll be a little book, and it will include anecdotes and stories from my own experience as well as political theory. So that's what I'm working on. I don't know if it'll work out, if it'll come out, but that's what I'm doing right now.
Sure. That sounds good. As a final question for you, hey, do you have any reading recommendations you would make to listeners as students of political theory in terms of the people who influenced your thought, and any recommendations of contemporary or actually complementary reads of a more contemporary nature that you would recommend?
The books that were most influential on my political development were three. Orwell's Homage to Catalonia, Camus' The Rebel, and a novel by the Italian Ignazio Cellone called Bread and Wine. And those are, I think, three wonderful books, and very formative in my own existence. I've been reading lately a lot of poetry, and I want to recommend one book from one of my favorite American poets, a man named Philip Levine, who died maybe 5-7 years ago. And the book is called What Work Is. What Work Is, and it's a series of, this is a guy who grew up in Detroit and worked in the auto factories. And these are poems about work. And they're quite wonderful poems, and they are, they're not political poems. They're just poems about what it means to work, what work is like. And they are a wonderful, not a foundation, but just a good base to start to think about what left politics is really about.
Well, nice. Thanks for mentioning some poetry. That I think shows your breadth of your thinking and thought. And just as one kind of aside, I had wanted to ask you about, did you know Albert A.O. Hirschman?
Yes, of course. He had the office across the hall from me at the Institute in Princeton. I knew him very, very well. And I've read quite a lot of his work and talked with him about it. I hope that development economists are still reading his work, because he had a view of how to overcome poverty in countries, especially in Latin America, that they can still learn from.
Yeah. And you were fortunate to have guys like Hirschman and Gertz. They weren't specialists just in their own field, a little bit like even Rorty. They kind of branch out and not just be, I don't know, locked into to a narrow specialization.
Right, right.
And I think that speaks to your situation as well, the way you write and express ideas. So thanks so much for spending so much time talking, and it's really a pleasure and an honor to talk to you. And look forward to seeing that new book when it comes out. And good luck with the projects, and keep up the dissent work.
As long as I can, yes. Thank you.